Our text this morning is from Psalm 30, verses 1 to 5. I will extol you, O Lord, for you have lifted me up and have not let my enemies rejoice over me. O Lord, my God, I cried to you for help, and you healed me. O Lord, you have brought up my soul from Sheol. You have kept me alive, that I would not go down to the pit. Sing praise to the Lord, you his people, and give thanks to his holy name. For his anger is but for a moment, his favor is for a lifetime. Weeping may last for the night, but a shout of joy comes in the morning.
Brian, I want to talk to you about shame this morning. Jesus and your battle with shame. Brian shamed me when we first met each other 40 years ago on the tennis court, consistently on the basketball court, one-on-one, consistently. But he never had the courage to step on the hockey rink and play it like a man. And I'm shaming you this morning. That's the Canadian sport. And you missed out on that. Seriously, let's go much deeper than that. 13 years ago, Joel, I was in a group with two other men, and we shared our lives to the deepest possible level. And Joel, who was at midlife taking another degree in counseling in the Seattle area, I was pastoring in the Seattle area at the time, Joel looked at me that day, I can still remember it, and he said, Morris, after I had talked for a little while, he said, Morris, that sounds like shame. He totally caught me off guard. It had never crossed my mind that I struggled with shame. I didn't know what he meant by that. I didn't even really know what shame was. Today, I see shame in so many areas of my life. And when I work with pastors and speak to people and process with people one-on-one, we uncover shame over and over and over again. I'd like to try and help us all understand why this morning. And possibly you might have said, I don't understand what shame is. When I started talking, maybe by the end of this talk this morning, we will have unpacked and opened up an area of your life where you can meet Christ and the freedom he gives you from shame in a new way. So John Bradshaw had the same experience I had, only he wrote a best-selling book back in the 1980s called Healing the Shame That Binds You. And he said, 10 years ago, I had one of those life-jolting discoveries that significantly changed everything. I named the core demon of my life. I named shame. This means that I became aware of the massive destructive power shame exerted on my life. I discovered that I had been bound by shame all my life. It ruled me like an addiction. I want to say that again because it's so true for all of us who uncover it. It ruled me and it rules many of us like an addiction. I lugged around inside of me a dead weight of not good enoughness. Today's leading voice on shame is Brené Brown, who calls herself a shame researcher. And works out of the University of Houston, has had TED Talks that have gone viral, 1.6 million people. She's hit the top 5 TED Talk list twice and has authored many books. Her first book in 2007 was, I Thought It Was Just Me, But It Wasn't, and It Isn't. And that opened her journey to being an author and a speaker as a shame researcher. And many of you are familiar with Brené's work, and so I'm keying off of that today. The result of her and people like John Bradshaw and others is a tidal wave of interest in the issues of shame by those who are doing the research and the spread from the TED Talks and the books that are being written. But out of her numerous books that Brené has written, she's given us no theological foundation for her work. Now, I understand that Brené is an Episcopal woman in an Episcopal church, and that she has done teaching in her church, and I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if she's connected shame theologically in her own community. But she does not in her books, and it's critical. A fundamental piece is missing. I want to give us that piece this morning. Because the truth of the matter is, while she has given us no theological framework for shame in her best-selling books, neither has the church. Take a look at this from an excellent book called Grace for Shame by John Forrester. It was written for pastors, but I give it to you. We Western pastors, we Western Christians, we pastors have a blind spot. In a word, that blind spot is shame. We don't learn about shame in seminary. That's where we go to get educated so we can properly teach you. We don't find it in our theological reading. We don't recognize it on the pages of Scripture. We don't see it in our people. Western theology, the past 500 years, has largely ignored shame. If we are going to minister grace for shame effectively, we need to reintegrate shame into our theology. When I started to study the Bible through the lens of seeing people who were living in shame, it just starts from one end and goes right through, especially in all the Old Testament narratives where we read about people. You just start thinking about all the Old Testament stories and how almost every one of them is a shame story in one way or another. Either people shaming each other or people feeling and experiencing shame in their relationship with God. You start to notice shame in your life, if you haven't, and start to look for it, and you realize, like Bradshaw, I'm lugging around a whole lot of shame. Brené has said, the less we understand shame and how it affects our feelings and thoughts and behaviors, the more power it exerts in our lives. The less we understand it, the more power shame exerts in our lives. And so until my late 40s, shame was exerting extensive power in my life, and I didn't know it. So I want to talk to you about shame in your life. Here's a definition of shame from Brené that I think was used by Bradshaw earlier on. Definition of shame, it's the inner voice that says you are not enough. This morning, you need to, with me, start thinking about all the areas in your life where you feel like you are not enough. It will relate to your body. I'm guessing that most of us here, when we see ourselves, when we get up in the morning and we see ourselves after we get out of the shower in front of the mirror and look at ourselves, we often have some feelings of, I wish I didn't look like this. It's a body thing. There's behaviors, all kinds of behaviors that we say, I wish I didn't live this way. And there's shame attached to that. There's relationships that are loaded with shame in our families of origin, in our existing families, friends, relationships, roommates, you name it. There's just shame in relationships everywhere. And I want you to know something about shame. If you shame someone, they tend to shame you back. And it just reverberates in relationships like this. We have to watch for the not enough voice. And if this was a seminar, I would have a whiteboard here. I would have a question on the whiteboard, and it would say, I'm afraid of not being or doing enough blank. And we would begin to say, what are the areas in your life where you feel like you are not enough? For someone, for God, or for yourself? I want to talk to you about two critical areas where shame shows up. First of all, spiritual practices. I want to talk to you about the shame of not feeling that you're enough for God. And then I want to talk to you about Christian living, the shame of not being enough or feeling like you are enough for others. So let's get started. Spiritual practices. The shame of not being or feeling like you are enough for God. How do you feel about this question? Which we ask a lot in churches, evangelical or churches like ours. This question, how are you doing spiritually? I hate that question. Because most of the time, I feel like I'm not doing good enough spiritually. And you do too. Because I know you. I've worked with too many people and been pastoring too long to know that most of us feel like we are not enough for God. There's a gap between who you are and who you know you should be. And you can let that gap be dealt with by grace, or you can turn it into a shame cycle and begin to ponder your not enoughness for God. And it will overcome you like an addiction. And you will lug that not enoughness around all of your life. How many of you are lugging a not enoughness around your prayer life? Oh, I know that one. And I can honestly say to you again, right up front, most of you who are serious about your Christian journey are lugging around I'm not enough regarding my prayer life. And you've been lugging it around for years. And I want to tell you something. It'll do absolutely nothing to help you become someone who's deeper and more intimate with Christ in your prayer life. It will help you in no way at all, yet you lug it around all your life. That's just one area that I'll pick on in our relationship with God that I have lugged around. Not enough for God. The voice of internal disgrace that you feel. And do you know what that voice does to your relationship with God? Christian living is another area. The shame of not being enough for others. My goodness. Not loving enough? How many men, if I asked you to stand and you wouldn't do it because you're too ashamed to do it, but would say, I'm not enough in my marriage? Guys, we all know that we're not enough in our marriages. We lug that one around day in and day out. And there are probably a lot of wives here who feel like you're not enough for your husband. We could talk about parenting. How many of you feel like I'm not enough in my parenting? Those of you who have married and have children. Some of you are ashamed of your singleness. Others of you are ashamed of your behavior in your family. How many of you are not loving enough toward your neighbors, and you've been saying that for weeks, months, or years? Or your coworkers? Or you're not loving enough in your church and you feel like you should do more. The not enoughness creeps into our families and all of our relationships. Let's talk about your abilities. How many of you feel like you're not succeeding or competent enough in the area that you work in, or where you're being watched or analyzed by other people? You just feel like, I'm not enough. I could be better. I know that. And it's a behavioral issue for us. Many of us feel like we're not enough in our behavioral way of living, and it leads to anger, and it leads to depression, and it leads to some kind of addictive behavior because we're lugging around the not enoughness in our Christian life and living at home, at church, on the street where we work. Listen to Lewis Smedes. Shame people translate criticism of what they do into judgment of who they are. They take it on as their identity. The feeling of shame is about our very selves, not about some bad thing we did or said, but about who we are. It tells us that we are unworthy. Now, the underlying player in the shame game is Satan himself. And if we're not aware of shame and processing our emotions around shame, then we're letting him have an open door into our soul on a regular basis. And we need to close that door. So let's establish a theological foundation for shame from the scriptures. Genesis 2:25 would be our starting text this morning. Adam and Eve were both naked and felt no shame. Genesis 2:25. We are right at the front of the Bible. And the first emotion that's mentioned is shame. Adam and Eve were naked and felt no shame. Now, that's an odd verse when you stop to think about it for a minute. Why would anyone think to suggest that shame would be an issue to discuss at the beginning of creation when Adam and Eve were in the garden? Why would anyone think to write that in? Why not Adam and Eve were naked and happy? I figure they must have been. Don't you? I would be. Look at this beautiful woman. Look at this beautiful man. I am naked and happy. Why not? They were naked and confident. Why not? They were naked and in love. That's what I'd write. But they were naked, and the author, God, says, felt no shame. Oh my goodness, do we have a clue to something important here in the creation narrative? Something that's fundamental to what will happen, that will start to open up the door for the enemy for all of the rest of humankind's living until Jesus Christ returns. Our battle with shame is about to begin. After the fall, we think about guilt, we preach about guilt, we process guilt, but the first thing we see in the creation narrative of Adam and Eve is shame. In fact, when sin enters, the first statements and the first descriptions are not about guilt after they fell into sin. The first descriptions are description of shame. Listen to the text in Genesis 3. Read it. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they realized they were naked. So they sewed fig leaves together and made coverings for themselves. What's happening? Shame has entered. Then the man and his wife heard the sound of the Lord as he was walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and they hid. What's happened? Shame. Shame between two people, shame between them and God. And they hid from the Lord in the trees of the garden. But the Lord called out to the man, "Where are you?" And he answered, "I heard you in the garden, and I was afraid." And you could substitute the word, "And I was ashamed. I was naked, so I hid." There is so much shame in the opening story of the fall of Adam and Eve. So much relational shame takes off. The first negative, destructive emotion needs to hiding and blaming. Genesis 3 is all about guilt, but it is framed in the emotion of shame. So how serious is shame according to the Genesis account? Kurt Thompson has written an excellent book called The Soul of Shame, which came out in the last couple of years. I want to quote from this book so you understand how serious shame is. Shame is not simply an unfortunate random emotional event. That's what I thought when I first discovered it. It's an unfortunate random emotional event. No, it's not. It is both a source and a result of evil's active assault of God's creation. In other words, Genesis 2:25, which we just read, is not just a passing description of humankind before Genesis 3. It is drawing our attention to the emotional fulcrum around which the history of sin rotates, the fundamental source, harbinger, and herald of what is to come. As such, the biblical narrative, when we experience shame, we are not simply encountering one of an array of possible emotions. Rather, listen, we are engaging in evil in its most fundamental mode of operation. Shame is the emotional weapon that evil uses to corrupt our relationships with God and each other. Oh my, what a powerful last sentence. Shame is the emotional weapon that evil uses to corrupt our relationships with God and each other. The not enoughness feeling with God is shame. The not enoughness feeling in your family of origin, your existing relationships, where you live and work, that shame covering that you feel falling over you time and again of not being enough is the emotional weapon that evil uses to corrupt your relationship with God and other people. Now, shame has been called the master emotion. As it is internalized, all other emotions are bound by it. Anger, fear, hate, rejection, disappointment, frustration are all linked to shame. Listen to it. Look at what Bradshaw says in his book. Any human emotion can become internalized. When internalized, an emotion stops functioning as an emotion and becomes an identity. Toxic shame is no longer an emotion that signals our limits. It is a state of being, a core identity. Some of us don't realize that shame is our core identity. I want to unmask shame this morning. I want to unmask shame in the lives of people who have not yet realized that you are lugging around a heavy weight of not good enoughness with God and with others, with yourself. It's become your core identity. And for many of us, it's linked to our own home, our church, our whole life and emotional well-being. Now, we need grace for guilt, but we also need grace for shame. Regarding guilt, you can take action and ask for forgiveness and make things right. We teach that you can be made right with God and your guilt can be taken away. And that's grace. Regarding shame, that's a totally different scenario that requires a different type of grace solution. Shame is tied to your identity, and actions can't cure it. You can't go to anyone and ask them to change your shame emotion. When shame comes in because of guilt, you can deal with the guilt. But what do you do with the emotion that continues to cycle around the fact that you're not enough, that you've not been enough, that you probably won't be enough again? It's free-floating. So let's move shame into a Christological answer. Let's go to Jesus, and let's see how Jesus addressed shame, since he knew it was the primary weapon of the enemy from Genesis 2 on. Pastor Jesus places three direct attacks on shame. I want to talk about the incarnation, Jesus and the incarnation. I want to talk about Jesus, the friend of sinners. And I want to talk about Jesus, the crucified one. First of all, solving and dealing with the shame issue. Here comes Pastor Jesus, the incarnation. Philippians 2, 6 and 7. Listen to this and bring it to the shame issue. Who, being in very nature God, with all of the privileges, rights from all eternity that God shares in his being, his essence, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage, but rather he made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. This passage, the word being made nothing, it's the word kenosis, and it means self-emptying. It means that Jesus took on humanity and did nothing out of his deity side so that he could say to us, I did it your way. I became fully human so that you can do it my way. So to be fully human, he took on all the shameful experiences that might enter the human journey. For God to become a fetus, for God to be born in a stable and have to be cleaned up after his birth, for God to eat with his hands as little children do and get all the stuff on the floor all over the place. For the God-man to become tired. For the God-man to have to go to the bathroom and have diarrhea. For the God-man to be tempted. For the God-man to experience all the shameful things that come with being a human being. Then he made his trip to the desert after he was called into the ministry. And what does the enemy do to Jesus? He says, I know you're human now, but you still are God. So if you're God, do something about it. And he shames him. He basically is saying to Jesus, if you are enough, take advantage of your deity. And he shames him three times. If you're enough, if you've got it within you, man, take care of your hunger. Turn those stones to bread. Hey, if you're enough, take care of the authority you once shared over all the kingdoms of the world. Ask them to bow down to you now, and they will, because you're God. Hey, if you're enough, Jesus, take care of your respect. Jump off the temple. When somebody challenges your enoughness, what do you do? I kick into higher gear and say, they'll never get at that spot again. I do not want to be shamed again. Jesus is being shamed at the very core of his deity. his godness, his God essence, which he has emptied himself of and set aside, but still is completely God, the God-man mystery, and has said, I will not use that. And Satan is saying, let's play with that. And if he'd have gotten in there and shamed him enough to do something at that spot, he would have changed the situation for Jesus and our hope for gospel salvation on the cross forever. It would have ended at that moment. Jesus understands what it means to be shamed because he was a human being. What preceded the desert was this. He was called the beloved son by his father. If dealing with guilt requires forgiveness, Jesus was always in a state of perpetual union with God, with no guilt between him and the Father. But to deal with shame, the power of dealing with shame is acceptance. And Jesus was unconditionally accepted by the Father and lived into that perpetual acceptance as the power to deal with the shame enemy that entered his life many times. You are my beloved son. And Jesus used that as the power, that power of acceptance to deal with shame. Secondly, here comes Pastor Jesus, friend of sinners. Let's move on from the incarnation to his ministry. What kind of a person was Jesus? You would be shocked if Jesus hung out in our culture. Religious people today would say about Jesus, look, a glutton and a winebibber, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. He hangs out with scum. Robin Stockett has said this, the most striking thing about the earthly ministry of Jesus is that he frequently chose to enter places of shame and associate with shamed people. Jesus was attracted to people who were living in shame. They were his target audience, weren't they? Zacchaeus, the shamed chief tax collector, Luke 9, verses 1 to 10, if you want to read it later today. It says that he was loathed as a tax collector. Loathed because he was a Jewish man who'd given himself over to the Romans to collect taxes from his people, and he was the chief tax collector who ripped people off. He was loathed. Jesus sees him up in the tree and calls for a dinner appointment, and Zacchaeus is to come down because Jesus says, I'm going to your house tonight. And what does it say about Jesus after he calls Zacchaeus down from the tree? The whole crowd is walking along with Jesus, having a great day with Jesus doing what Jesus does, talking and chatting. When he sees Zacchaeus, calls Zacchaeus down, leaves the crowd, and walks away with Zacchaeus to his house. You know what it says? All of the people saw this and began to mutter, he has gone to be the guest of a sinner. They began to mutter. He has gone to be the friend of a shameful sinner. Jesus' participation sets himself to be shamed by everyone else. He knows he's going to take on shame by hanging out with Zacchaeus. That doesn't concern him. What are the other stories I could tell you about today? But we don't have time. Jesus standing by the woman caught in adultery. Jesus with the prostitute at Simon the Pharisee's party, washing him with her tears and her hair. Jesus touching the untouchables, which you didn't do because it excommunicated you for a while from being able to go into the temple and worship. When you touch a leper, when you touch a woman with an issue of bleeding, or she touches you and you accept it and heal her. Jesus violates boundaries with untouchables over and over and over again. Shame-bound people were not intimidated by Jesus. This is what was so beautiful about Jesus' life. Shame-bound people were not intimidated by him. They were drawn to him in life, and they found release from their shame by what? Acceptance. The acceptance of Jesus for people in shame. Let's move to the third way that Jesus attacks and addresses shame. Here comes Pastor Jesus, the crucified one. The shame of the cross is beyond your imagination. Shame was central to the crucifixion itself. Romans opted for crucifixion for its public, humiliating quality. The cross is the ultimate tale of a person being labeled as an outcast. Jesus endured actual, concrete shame. This is fulfilled in Isaiah's vision of God's servant who would bear tremendous shame. This spear point of Jesus' attack on shame is at the cross. The death at the cross is preceded by all kinds of humiliation before you finally are nailed to it. First of all, the arrest for Jesus and having his hands tied behind his back. Brian's a special person to all of us as a pastor, right? Jesus was held in the highest regard by his disciples. But the temple police came and arrested him in the middle of the garden prayer time and tied his hands behind his back. If any one of you, particularly our lead pastor, was arrested and walked out by an officer right now, the shame on Brian would be intense, and on all of us, we'd be left going, wow. And they fled from the shame. They didn't want to be around Jesus. The arrest is shaming. The abandonment by the disciples was particularly shaming for Jesus. Would you pray with me? No, we're running away in a few minutes. The trumped up charges are shaming. Have you ever been trumped up on something and been accused of something you didn't do? What do you do right away? You don't buy into that shaming and you become very defensive. It says Jesus was silent in the shaming of the trumped up charges. The scourging is shaming as you give your back over to be torn open by a soldier that's just having fun flogging you. Carrying the cross and falling down is shaming as people are mocking you on your way to the cross. Being nailed to the cross is the height of shaming as you are hung up between two thieves. What a shaming experience for God to hang between two thieves, nailed to the cross. The religious leaders are mocking Jesus. If your God, come down and prove it. Another shaming work of the enemy. If your God, come down, and Jesus said, I could call 10,000 angels right now, and I will not. I will bear the shame of every person from the beginning of time on this cross. I will bear it for them. And I want to say something to you to end this cross scenario of shame. We always see Jesus, if you're looking at the crucifix in art or a Catholic church, you always see him with his loincloth on. And I say, good, but you need to know, there was no undergarment on. Jesus was crucified naked in front of his mother. John 19, verses 23 and 24. When the soldiers crucified Jesus, they took his clothes, dividing them into four shares, the shirt, whatever, the pants, the shoes, whatever you want to talk about in our culture. They took them all up, and they divided them up and gambled for them with the undergarment remaining, the loincloth. This garment was seamlessly woven, as we see it in the pictures of the cross, in one piece from top to bottom. Let's not tear it, they said to one another, as they took it off of him and he became completely naked. Let's decide who by lot will get it. So this is what the soldiers did, and then they nailed him to the cross naked. Jesus is as low as any shamed person has ever been. John Forrester, the book on shame I quoted earlier on, says this: Christ goes to the deepest place of shame so that the most abused person could know him as a real friend. If you're a shamed person here this morning, if you're beginning to sense as I'm talking that you lug around a feeling of not good enoughness, Jesus is on the cross hanging naked. We need to join Jesus in undoing the shame game. How do we do that? Hebrews 12, verses 1 and 2 gives us the key of three responses we make to end. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders us and the sin that so easily entangles us and brings shame. Some of you are shamed by all kinds of sinful behavior. Throw it off. It'll entangle you. And let's run with perseverance the race marked before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith. How did he pull this off? For the joy set before him, he endured the cross. We skip over these words too quickly, scorning the shame. And then he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. First, if you're going to deal with shame in your life, you need to scorn the shame. You need to track down your shame messages and scorn them. Jesus is laid bare on the cross, the crosshairs of shame. And shame means to look down on someone and despise them. You know what he is going to do? He is going to stare shame down on the cross and scorn it. The very shame that is trying to be heaped on him and in him, he's going to stare shame down and scorn it, according to Hebrews 12, verse 2. He scorned the shame. Let's go back to the nakedness. In the garden, Adam and Eve were naked and unashamed, and then became what? Sinful, and they must have been naked, and we read it. They were very ashamed. Do you know what Jesus is doing on the cross? He's back in the garden on a tree, and he's hanging there naked and unashamed. He has taken all the shame that you and I have ever experienced through all of our sinful behavior, all of our broken relationships, all of our addictive behavior, all of our not good enoughness. He's got it all hanging on him right there, and he is scorning the shame for you and for me. And he is staring it down and hanging there and saying to the world, I am naked and unashamed because I am the Son of God, taking this shame on myself for everyone I love, all of humanity. For God so loved the world, he took all of our shame on himself and bore it on the cross. He stared it down for you so that you can stare it down now in your life. Kurt Thompson says this, the point here is to emphasize that Jesus' literal naked vulnerability is a testimony to us that he knows exactly what it is like to be us. To truly be with us, Jesus Emmanuel, not only knows what it means to be vulnerable, he knows how painfully, frighteningly hard it is to live into it, given shame's threat. It couldn't have been more challenging than to scorn it down on the cross, but that's what Jesus did. Isaiah 50, 6 to 8 says it so perfectly. I offered my back to those who beat me, my cheeks to those who pulled out my beard. I did not hide my face from mocking and spitting. I took it all because the sovereign Lord helps me. I will not be disgraced. Therefore, I have set my face like a flint, and I know I will not be put to shame. He does something every person in this room is asked to do now. Scorn shame. Rob it of its power. Be intentional about it. Do you know that the enemy wants to convince you that shaming you is God's strategy to get you to be a better person? And you've bought that voice? It perpetually plays its way into the church, every denomination, from the beginning of church history. Shame as a way to get people to behave better. You need to scorn that. That will never get you there. That is not God's way of getting you there. Unconditional acceptance. Naked and unashamed on the cross, Jesus is for you. So, first, Jesus scorned the shame. Second thing we're invited to do is share your shame. The need for vulnerability, the courage to tell other people what areas of your life you are ashamed in. Since it was personal relationships that set up the toxic shame, we need personal relationships to heal our shame. Brené Brown is all over this. Courage, courage to talk about where you're shamed in your life. Not with everyone, but with some people that are close to you. Brené says, vulnerability is the last thing I want you to see in me, but the first thing I look for in you. Vulnerability. The last thing I want you to see in me, but the first thing I look for in you. So she invites us, as Jesus certainly does, to be open and honest about our shame and not to hide, not to retreat, not to isolate in our shame and let it have more power over us. If we turn away from others in our shame about the things that we're not enough in and don't feel enough about, if we turn away from our shame, it reinforces the shame. In every relationship where you feel shame, you need to talk the shame out. You need to vulnerably put it on the table and let healing be brought to you by Jesus, first of all, by the Trinity, by the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and then by the body of Christ, someone who will come around you and hear your story and reinforce the fact that God does not shame you. There are men in this auditorium that are so ashamed of their sexual addiction. If you are not vulnerably talking to other men about it and processing your shame, and you're actually thinking shame is your way out, I will shame myself out of addiction, you will never break your addiction. If you think God is shaming you out of your pornographic addiction or your alcohol addiction or your worry addiction or your overeating addiction, if you think God or others are going to shame you out of that behavior, you are on the wrong pathway. You have got to scorn shame and take a totally different pathway, which involves unconditional acceptance from the starting point. Jesus is going to walk with you as long as you're struggling with that. He will walk with you and love you. That will lead you to a better place. Shame is induced relationally, so it must be undone relationally. Vulnerability is the way we shame shame. Where do you name shame in your life today? Have you named it? And can you name it with someone else? Would you, if you're married, would you quit shaming your spouse and creating a shame reverberation back and forth between you and your spouse? You're killing your marriage with your reverberating shame-based marriage. With your parents, stop the shame-based game that's going back and forth between parents and children. We could just go on and on, but let's move to the third one to wrap it up. First, Jesus scorned the shame. Secondly, he invites us to share it in community. And thirdly, I'll pick up where I left off the last time I spoke here. We need to surrender to love. Do you know what shame is? Shame is a way that reinforces our willingness to not surrender to love, to instead turn away and allow a plexiglass wall to build up between us and God. We can see him, but we're in too much shame to be in relationship with him. We're going to have to stand to that plexiglass wall and then come through it and find out that we live in unconditional acceptance. You are going to have to surrender to love. And for that, I send you back to your website. The sermon is there somewhere. And listen to Surrender to Love. But I just know that this is the God who's coming to you today in all of your shame, because the Father, whose Son Jesus uses as a parable, whose Son shamed his dad, grabbed his inheritance, went off and made out probably with prostitutes, drugs if he could find them, alcohol, partying, and all kinds of wild living, came back shamed to his Father and said, "I am not worthy to be your son, but I will slave for you if you'll just let me back in." And the Father says, "We'll have nothing of it. Stop the shame talk. Put the robe and the ring on him. He needs to surrender to love. He will not make it if he slaves for me. He will never know how to get past the shame until he is the son again. And let's go of all that." So the Father says, "Stop the shaming. You will not slave for me. Your better devotional life, your better prayer life, you're trying to be a better witness, you're trying to be involved in social justice, all of your self-effort to deal with your shame is not what God is interested in. He wants all kinds of holy, righteous behavior that's birthed out of unconditional love. Because you love him, you engage in relationships with him that lead you deeper. But shame will lead you nowhere. You need to surrender to love. Put on the ring and the robe and sit down in the presence of the God who loves you." Lewis Smedes, to wrap it up, "The simplest of remedies for shame is the discovery that we are, in spite of everything,
accepted by the grace of someone we need to accept us. The surest cure for the feeling of being in an unacceptable person is the discovery that we are accepted by the grace of the one whose acceptance matters most to us. And so the verse is Psalm 34:5 that I leave you with today. Those who look to him are radiant. Their faces are never covered with shame.